Hello, this is Ukraine Calling, a weekly roundup of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Marta Dechok for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here are the headlines that caught my attention this week.
Yet again, we have seen an increase in the level of violence in Donetsk region.
Тож за минулу добу внаслідок бойових дій один український воїн загинув, шість зазнали поранень.
So the reports of the slow drip of death have been coming in daily. Three killed and three wounded on one day, three killed and 16 wounded on another. One killed and five wounded on another, and seven killed and 13 wounded on yet another. It becomes something of a blur.
Вот у нас буквально за последнее время, хотя мы здесь как неделю находимся, у нас уже более 7 задержаний. Люди, которые находятся в розыске за подозрение в сепаратизме.
You know, the people of Crimea, from what I've heard, would rather be with Russia than where they were.
The week's news began with Donald Trump's statement that he might look at recognizing Russia's annexation of Crimea, his odd commentary that Putin was not in Ukraine, and then blaming Obama for that whole part of the world being a mess. Meanwhile, war continued on Ukrainian territory. Three Ukrainian soldiers were killed over the past 7 days, and 25 were injured. Last week, the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission in Ukraine reported a 25% increase in hostilities. Pilot-turned MP Nadia Savchenko announced that she was going on a new hunger strike this Tuesday, that she would not eat until all prisoners of war were released. Hromadske Radio's leaders traveled to the area near the war last weekend, to the town of Volnovakha. They met with listeners, potential listeners, city officials, and local journalists. CEO Andriy Kulikov said that shelling could be heard, and that while people have adapted, they want peace. Sadly, war seems to have become the new normal in Ukraine. We'll bring you more on that with expert commentary by Professor Oleksiy Harany and journalist analyst Brian Whitmore later in the show. Two high-level officials from the previous Yanukovych regime made the headlines in Ukraine this week. Oleksandr Yefremov was detained in Kyiv's Boryspil airport on Saturday. He was attempting to leave the country. Once, he headed up the Regions Party faction in parliament. That's the party of the now fugitive former President Yanukovych. Yefremov is facing charges of embezzlement of state funds, inciting hatred, and taking actions aimed at violating Ukraine's territorial integrity. The other name from the past that reappeared in the news this week was Mykola Azarov. He was Yanukovych's prime minister from 2010 through January of 2014. This week he was called in for questioning by Ukraine's new prosecutor's office. The case is about embezzlement of state funds in the gas sector. It's unlikely that Azarov will show up in the Kyiv court, since he fled to Russia along with Yanukovych back in 2014. His international assets have been frozen, and Interpol has put him on their wanted list. Azarov's son Oleksiy has also been summoned. Three judges were dismissed this week by Ukraine's President Poroshenko on the recommendation of the Supreme Justice Council. Natalia Maltseva and Natalia Spasova are from Donetsk. Vladislav Oberemko is from Kyiv. They were all accused of breaching their oath. A new single registry for internally displaced people was launched on the 1st of August by Ukraine's Ministry of Social Policy. The aim is to centralize information about those people displaced from Crimea and the Donbas. Until now, lists were kept by various authorities. This led to confusion and occasional double dipping into state services. Now the ministry is creating an electronic database to better serve those in need, although this is still a trial phase. And now it's official. Kyiv has the Stepan Bandera Avenue. You'll remember in July, Ukraine Calling reported that the city council had voted to rename Moscow Avenue and that the Kremlin had protested. But Kyiv's mayor was away on vacation. This week, Vitaly Klitschko returned, signed the decision, and made it official. Last Sunday, U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump made even more waves than usual. In an ABC interview, he suggested that he might look at recognizing Russia's annexation of Crimea, and that he, meaning the Russian President Putin, was not in Ukraine. Meanwhile, in eastern Ukraine, war continues and appears to be escalating, but it's no longer making the international headlines. To speak about these issues, we have with us in studio Oleksiy Harany, professor of political science at the National University of the Kyiv-Mohyla Academy and the head of research at the Democratics Initiative Foundation. And joining us from Prague via Skype is Brian Whitmore. He's the senior Russia analyst for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty in Prague. He's the author of the Power Vertical blog and host of the Power Vertical podcast, which many of you probably listen to, both of which focus on Russian affairs. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with Professor Harany. You know that last Sunday, Donald Trump said, quote, "The people of Crimea, from what I've heard, would rather be in Russia than where they were." He also said that Russian President Putin is not in Ukraine. He was then corrected by the journalist George Stephanopoulos. Well, he's really there, isn't he? And Trump said, okay, he's in a certain way, and then sort of tried to blame Obama for it. What do you make of this? What does this mean for Ukraine?
Well, first of all, it's one of more other statements of Trump regarding the Mexicans, Muslims, transatlantic partnership, ability of NATO to, or inability of NATO to defend other countries. So he had already made a lot of statements, how to put it diplomatically. Which are not really correct. I'm saying it very, very diplomatically. But definitely what he said about Crimea, this is a shock for Ukrainians because it shows that either Trump do not understand international relations, he doesn't know what already happened in Crimea, or he's very cynical. He knows, but he doesn't want to recognize it. And there were some articles. There was an article about his counselor Manafort, who was previously counselor to Yanukovych.
Former president of Ukraine,
very corrupt, the person who would like to become dictator, and finally was ousted from as a result of Maidan massive protests in Ukraine. So, and now Manafort is advising to Trump. There was an article in New York Times, I believe, about that. And definitely, again, this is a shocking statement. And I would say that it's in many Ukrainian media and it's discussed by experts. So again, I think this is not wise. And again, this is very diplomatic expression, not wise. And I think, again, it demonstrates that Trump simply doesn't grasp international relations and also international obligations of the United States and importance of Eastern Europe in general for American security.
And there was that delegation of French parliamentarians that visited Crimea. This all got me thinking about, is this the new normal? Crimea has been annexed. War is continuing in eastern Ukraine. And I'd like to turn to Mr. Whitmore here. Politicians are making statements across this on the other side of the Atlantic. Here in Ukraine, the war is continuing. And you produced a very interesting series of podcasts that caught my attention. And you called this the war in Ukraine the invisible war, that at a time last July when there was the highest number of casualties since 2015, the war is almost not appearing in international media. What does this mean? Is this the war isn't the new normal? What are the implications of this?
Yeah, Marta, I think that's part of it. I mean, I called it the invisible war, and in today's Daily Vertical, I called it the war without end. And I'll explain why I think that in a minute. July was indeed the deadliest month in the Donbas in a year in terms of both civilian casualties and troops killed in action. Now, part of this is cyclical. Summer, as we know, is fighting season. And the fighting tends to spike in the summer. But part of it is that the peace process is completely stalled. And part of it's that you have a lot of armed men in the occupied parts of Donbas who have no life to go back to. Without the war, they have nothing. But the real reason I think this is happening, and the real reason I think this is going to continue to happen, and the real reason I think this is a war without end, is that in a broader sense, I mean, there's no way to reconcile the two sides on this. Russia is not going to accept any settlement that does not give Russia de facto veto over Ukraine's future political direction. And the authorities in Kyiv, not to mention the Ukrainian people, quite sensibly and reasonably, I think, aren't going to accept any settlement that does give Moscow a veto over Ukraine's future. And this is when you cut through all the minutiae of Minsk, this is what you have. You have these two irreconcilable positions. One of them, the Russian position, quite unreasonable, I think, and the Ukrainian position, I think, quite more than reasonable. But this is why the Minsk process was flawed from the get-go. And this is why Minsk is, for all intents and purposes, dead in the water. It's a war without end for this reason. So, and one other thing I would add is that really the war in the Donbas, it's really Moscow's only leverage over Kyiv. They can't rely on a lot of the other levers they used to rely on to pre-war to influence Ukraine. They went all in on the war, and without the war, they really have nothing. So it's, in a sense, it's in Moscow's interest to keep this simmering at a low boil, unless they get what they want, which Kyiv is not going to give to them, to keep this simmering at a low boil, because it's the only form of leverage they have. And if the war ended on any other terms other than the unreasonable demands that Moscow is making, then Moscow would stand to lose all its leverage. So therefore, I just don't see a way out. I wish that were not the case, but I believe that is the case, and it's not good, and it's particularly not good for those people that are living along the front lines in the Donbas.
Professor Harang, same question to you: have Ukrainians become used to the fact of war, getting on with their daily lives, and just hoping that their sons, their brothers, their husbands don't get called up?
Actually, this is a very difficult question to answer, because on the one hand, definitely Ukrainians do not want to recognize that the occupied parts of Donbas, they will not return to Ukraine on Ukrainian terms. Then Ukrainians do not want this territories to be reintegrated under Russian conditions, because again, it, as Brian rightly said, it will give a lot of leverage over Ukrainian affairs in the Russian hands. On the other hand, psychologically, yes, maybe people, they live under these conditions and they become adapted to this. So life in Kyiv looks peaceful, you know. So some people may watch it as, you know, it happens somewhere in a very, very distant region. Well, actually, if you look at the map of Ukraine, you'll see that the territory which is controlled by pro-Russian proxies in lonely margin, just, you know, 3% of Ukrainian territory. So definitely, if you want to disprove some allegations that this is a civil war, just look at the map. Look at the map and everything would be clear. So I think what can be the way out of it, and it seems to me that on the one hand, we need to have a strong Ukrainian army which can seal this frontline zone. On the other hand, definitely, I believe that Western sanctions should be in place. And we know that this is not easy, because the sanctions now are EU sectoral sanctions are until January 31st next year. But then we don't know what would happen. And Russia is trying to divide the EU. Actually, we don't know what will happen. So I believe there's a lot of questions here. But nevertheless, I think what is important for Ukraine is we may keep this conflict even as frozen conflict, okay? But to try to concentrate on reforms in the rest of Ukraine, in Ukraine itself. Because I believe this is part of Putin's scenario, so as Brian rightly said, to use it in order to destabilize Ukrainian economic and political situation. So perhaps one of the way out would be just to recognize that we cannot control the territories, try to seal this front line. So definitely we need improvement of capacity of Ukrainian army. And here I think the Western support would be also crucial, not only in supplying some systems, military systems, but also in helping to reform the Ukrainian army. And then for Kyiv to concentrate on reforms within Ukraine. This would be the best answer to Putin and to what he's doing in Donbass.
I think Alexei hits the nail on the head here, quite frankly, if I may interject.
Marcia. Please, please.
Yeah. No, I mean, Ukraine needs to focus on what it can control. Ukraine cannot control what's going on in the occupied parts of Donbass right now, because Russia is just not going to give that territory back. If Ukraine made a military push to take it back, all Russia would do is surge troops across the border like they've done in the past and push Ukraine back. So there's really little that Ukraine can do. You're stuck with this stalemate right now. But what Ukraine can do is concentrate on reforming its economy and reforming its political system and turning what the vast majority of Ukraine that the authorities in Kyiv do control into a success story. And that would be the best answer to Mr. Putin. And I think sooner or later, the people in the occupied parts of Donbass will think twice about which side of that line they want to live on. I know which side any sane person would want to live even now. And if you have a Ukraine that reforms itself and becomes a successful, viable European state, well, the choice is a no-brainer.
And we need an adequate Western reaction to what's going on. Definitely, it's not Trump reaction, you know.
Well, what would be an adequate reaction? You've mentioned the sanctions. People have been talking about sanctions. The Minsk process is failed, as Brian pointed out.
So the best way, actually, would be to decouple sanctions from Minsk process, which is dead. And if we remember, actually, the sanctions were introduced even before Minsk I agreement. So they were introduced because of MH17 and because Russian troops appeared in Donbass. That's the main story. So I believe the sanctions should be kept because of that. So we don't need any talk about, you know, so-called elections in the occupied areas. You know, it's impossible to have free and fair elections there. But again, the real question is whether the West would be united on that, because we see these differences within the EU, and actually American position was very important in keeping EU sanctioned. So that's why we look with so much attention to the presidential campaign in the United States, because definitely American position, you know, and the understanding of what's going on is really on the ground is really important, you know, for keeping sanctions.
Well, I would say, as a political analyst, I'm quite confident that when all the votes are counted, the American president is going to be somebody that's friendly to Ukraine. I'll just leave it at that. But I agree with you, Alexei, that we need to get away from the modalities of Minsk. All of these discussions about sequencing and whether the elections happen first or Russia gives the border back first. This is exactly the conversation Moscow wants, because they can keep having this conversation about this minutiae and about these modalities, where the larger macro issue that, let's face it, Russia invaded Ukraine, is ignored. And Russia is able to point the finger that Ukraine hasn't fulfilled Minsk because they haven't had elections in a war zone. So the first thing we really need to do is get away from these modalities, get away from the whole Minsk process, I would argue, because it's a failure. It was a flawed deal from the start. It served a purpose of stopping the fighting at the time, but it was clear to anybody who knew anything about this conflict that it was not gonna work. We got to get away from Minsk. In terms of the sanctions, I think you're absolutely right. Decouple the sanctions from Minsk. I'm of the opinion the sanctions should be made semi-permanent. I'm of the opinion that Moscow is waging a kinetic and non-kinetic war against the West. The kinetic part's happening in Ukraine. The non-kinetic part is happening with all sorts of other things they're doing in the West, such as, you know, hacking the Democratic National Committee's email servers, for example. But I think that we should be focusing on a non-kinetic containment of Russia, and sanctions are a big part of that. So I think you're absolutely right about that.
I mean, Sorry to interrupt, Brian. Well, sure. You used this wonderful word, kinetic. Can you explain to our listeners what you mean by that?
Well, kinetic is where you're using force, and non-kinetic is when you're not using overt force. I could use a different word.
No, that's a great word. I wasn't sure everybody understood it. So thank you for explaining. And Alexei is nodding his head here saying, aha, yes, that's exactly what the lines that he was going on. Did you want to jump in here, Alexei?
Yeah, I fully agree with Brian. The problem is, unfortunately, with the readiness of Western politicians, and first of all, European politicians, to strongly resist to Putin, what Putin is doing. And unfortunately, we know that some politicians in Europe, you know, they follow this approach of Putin verstehe. So I believe understanding Putin, we need to take Russia's security concerns into account, and so on and so forth. So actually a lot would depend on what would happen during presidential elections in France and parliamentary elections in Germany. And again, presidential elections in the United States. So unfortunately, what Putin is doing, you know, he's following the tactic of every dictator against democracy. He is trying to use democratic rules in these countries in order to undermine democratic procedures and in order to undermine the ability to resist. That's what happened on the eve of World War II, the tactics which was used by Stalin and Hitler. And again, a lot would depend on the readiness of European politicians and on the public opinion as well, because Putin is trying to manipulate this public opinion. So,
and
yes,
seemingly both, successfully in some ways.
In some ways, yes, actually. And again, yeah, with Brian, I fully agree that I'm happy that you agree with me that we need to decouple sanctions from Minsk process. But the question is whether these cautious, pragmatic European politicians would like to do that, because they're afraid, you know, to provoke Putin, to escalate the conflict. So, unfortunately, I don't think that now they are ready to do that, frankly speaking. So it means that we need, you know, especially for Ukraine, we need to play with this Minsk process. As one analyst, political scientist said, well, Minsk is a theater. Everybody is playing, you know, his role. And for Ukraine, it's important to continue to play the role. Yes, we're in favor. We don't want to violate. We need Minsk agreements to be fully implemented. Yes, we need to keep it, you know, unless the West would be ready for more decisive steps.
And in the current season, I agree with you, Alexei. I don't see the West being ready for more decisive steps. I think you pinpointed exactly the parliamentary elections in Germany and the presidential elections in France are the key things to watch. I'm actually pretty confident that those two elections will turn out well for Ukraine as well.
Brian, I am knocking on the wood, you know.
We were always knocking on the wood. That's one of the mottos of my life whenever I say something like that. But I think right now, the best thing Ukraine could hope for is a frozen conflict right now in the Donbass, to be honest.
Yeah, that's I agree with that. Yeah.
I don't think you're going to get it. I think you're going to get a simmering conflict.
Yeah.
I think you're going to get a conflict that's going at a low boil like it is right now, as opposed to the classic frozen conflicts in Georgia's Abkhazia region and South Ossetia regions and Moldova's Transnistria regions, where those conflicts truly are frozen. But I think Moscow learned a lesson from that whole experience, is that when the conflicts became frozen in Georgia, what happened in the rest of Georgia? Well, it turned completely pro-Western. Right, because the pro-Moscow parts of the country were in these frozen conflict zones, and I think they understand correctly that the exact same thing is going to happen in Ukraine. So they're going to try to keep this thing going and simmering at a low boil. They're going to keep trying to divide Europe and again play to these Putin understanders in order to get sanctions lifted. I mean, it was a close call last time around when the Commission voted on sanctions, although they did manage to get it through. We'll see what happens in January, but I don't think until this round of elections at least is over that I don't see the conversation changing into turning towards decoupling the sanctions from Minsk. I would like to see that, but I honestly don't see it happening.
So we have a huge task facing Ukraine and prospects for peace somewhere on the horizon.
And I would say in that the huge task for Ukraine is to focus on what it can control. And what it can control is get moving with the reforms and turn the parts of Ukraine they do control, the vast majority of Ukraine, into a success story. That's the best answer to Mr. Putin.
Alexei,
I fully agree.
Thank you very much for your insight, for joining us. And hopefully next time we meet, there will be more positive news to report. Thank you very much.
The positive news, as I am always saying, is that Ukraine resisting Putin. Ukrainian army is resisting the strongest army in Europe. So Ukraine survived despite all Putin plans. So that's the reason for optimism.
And I would add to that, yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty remarkable that Ukraine basically fought Russia to a draw in a war. That's pretty remarkable. But in order to preserve that remarkable victory, Ukraine has to win the war of governance now. Ukraine has to turn itself into a successful, prosperous European state. And unless it does that, that victory of fighting the largest army in the world to a draw would have been in vain.
Well, the task is now with the politicians in Ukraine and other parts of the world. Thank you very much for joining us. Something that has struck me about Ukraine since the war began in 2014 is that despite being under attack, people here continue to make music and sing. This week, I'd like to share two songs with you. Both deal with the issue of war. One was written and recorded by Bohdan Kovalchin, a young man from Drohobych who was sent to the front. He wrote a song called Separatyuha. He hoped that a musician friend of his would perform it, but ended up performing it himself.
Треба стерти ту падлу з землі, зжимаю рідну СВД, вона мене не підведе. Файно, що вітер в сторону дебіла, і моя куля полетіла. Сепаратюга, а ти як шлюха, серед степу стоїш і думаєш собі, що все нормально, куля вже полетіла. Чекай від мене український привіт, сепаратюга, а ти як шлюха, в канаві лежиш і тихо смердиш. В ліпшім разі вагоном, спецешелоном, зручні упаковці за кордон повалиш. Вже заблудився в іншій стороні. Сепаратюга, а ти як шлюха, серед степу стоїш і думаєш собі, що все нормально, куля вже полетіла. Чекай від мене український привіт. Сепаратюга, а ти як шлюха, в канаві лежиш і тихо смердиш. В ліпшім разі вагоном, зручні упаковці за кордон повало. Слава Україні, героям слава! Слава ВДВ, слава, слава! Небо сяє від зірок, до своїх всього лиш крок. І я розглядаю зорі голубі, а там же повно безпілотно.
мразі вагоном, спец ешелоном, зручні упаковці за кордон повалиш.
The other is by a band called Plotnik 82, and it's called Rodinu Nyadvomnya, excuse my pronunciation, which means I don't have a homeland. It's the song from the other side of the front. Both songs were played on Hromadske Radio's weekly music show Pororoku.
Все делиться только на хороших, плохих. Одні патріоти обличают других, і ти можеш стати одним із них. И ты можешь стать одним из них. Но только кончилось лето в ледяной полынье, и я остался где-то на другой стороне. Родины нет во мне, родины нет во мне. Еще одна эпоха превращается в миг. Одни патриоты убивают других, и ты можешь стать одним из них, и ты можешь стать одним из них. А кто-то пьет свое пиво и доволен вполне, а кто-то лезет на трибуны в своем нижнем белье. Родины нет во мне, родины нет во мне. Соображать на троих, пока одни патриоты хоронят других, и ты можешь стать одним из них, и я могу стать одним из них. А свобода — это козырь у меня в рукаве, свобода — это опухоль в моей голове. Только родины нет во мне, снова родины нет во мне.
Ukraine's athletes will be competing for gold in Rio in the coming days. Before leaving for the Olympic Games, the 205 athletes held a parade in central Kyiv and lay flowers in memory of Ukrainian soldiers who have died in the war zone. Ukraine placed 14th in the last Olympic Games in London in 2012. This year, for the first time, they'll be competing in synchronized swimming, fencing, and kayaking events. We'll be watching to see how they do and all the other news. Tune in next week for a new episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Marta Dachok in Kyiv. Let me know what you think. Our new email address is ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. That's ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. Thanks for listening.